Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
You are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who stab ground cloth repeatedly with a needle.
Yes.
That's for you.
Today I'm stabby.
Yeah. My day's been pretty decent, but that one's for you. Yeah.
It works.
Yes. So heard from Kathy Locurto. Off of the FlossTube version of the podcast, interested in the bicycle touring.
Mm-hmm.
And said she was all geared up to do some touring in the Sierras, I think it was.
Oh,
yeah, which, you know, that would be okay. I mean, I've never been in the mountains with a bike, but I'd give it a try. And then moved to a city and lost her momentum, but she was curious about it. And then asked if I took stitching along. And no, I take, because when my sister and I do it, we're what do they call that? Credit card tourists.
Credit card.
Yeah. Yeah. We stay in hotels because showers and real beds are, appealing. So we, super eights mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. You know, we share a room and, we work out, we have kind of a system so that each can, when we get to the room, one takes a turn and showers and washes out your cycling clothes, and then the other, and then we hang clothes all over bikes and all over the room to dry by morning. And most mornings it gets dry, but some mornings it's a little clammy. So
yeah, I can appreciate that. So I was saying before, I took my motorcycle into work today, and So riding into work wasn't that bad because it was only about 80 degrees. Coming back, it was about 90 something.
Uh-huh.
And 90 something on a bike, on a motorcycle, is, you know, not too pleasant. But in traffic, it gets less pleasant because you're not going fast, which is, of course, your only cooling device. And the one difference between a motorcycle and a bike is the motorcycle gets really hot because you're kind of sitting on an engine.
Yeah.
Right. So, and the thing is, on a bike, you're wearing shorts and pretty light gear. And on a motorcycle, at least for me, I'm wearing, you know, armored gear and full leather, you know, well, not leather jacket, but, you know, padded gear and all kinds of stuff. And boots and jeans and gloves and full helmet. So by the time I get home, it's pretty hot. So I can appreciate the need for shower.
and
it's exhausting. By the time you get there, you know, my commute's about 35 miles. So by the time you get home, even though you're not pedaling, especially on a windy day where you're wrestling the bike to stay going where you're going, especially in the heat, it's bad. But that said, I would rather be going fast than to be stuck in traffic where you're just stopped.
Right.
Because then it's just hot.
Yeah, because that's the thing with a motorcycle. If you can keep moving, you have to wear the clothes. But if you can keep moving, you stay comfortable, I assume, or relatively comfortable.
More comfortable.
But I'm sure the minute you stop, the heat just builds like pronto.
Yeah. Right, and if it's stopped and like stop and go traffic where it's like completely stopped, then you just shut the engine, and that, well, first of all, it helps you preserve your engine because you just don't have any, you know, real. It depends on the type of engine you have, honestly, but you know, the engines are built to be air cooled, right?
Right.
So you really need to be moving.
Yes.
So you know, if you're going to be stopped, you just shut your engine off.
Yeah.
And then when you start again, you start your engine, you move. But when you're in stop and go traffic, you can imagine how pleasant that becomes.
Right. Yeah. That's just, yeah. Can you ride between lanes in New York?
No.
Oh.
No, you can't. Now, that doesn't mean people don't do that.
Okay.
I would not do that.
Always seemed like a dangerous proposition to me, but
in a place where it would be legal, it probably would be less dangerous because people would expect it. In a place where it's not legal, wouldn't do it. I'm a very by the book rider, just because I still am a little bit tentative about things. So I tend to go by the book about things. I follow the rules.
Yeah.
So I don't like doing things like that. So yes, could you do that? You could. Is it illegal? Yeah, it's also illegal. So there's that.
Yeah.
And most riders would do that. They would lane split, but I don't feel comfortable doing it. I imagine in a few years, I probably would on occasion do that. Or what people will do is pull onto the shoulder and just kind of take the shoulder.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's unpleasant.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, that's with bike riding. You know, no, I don't take stitching, because the first time we toured, it was from St. Louis on old Route 66 all the way back to Chicago. And and it was hot the whole way. And that was where we learned that you only haul what you absolutely need. You don't take anything. So like we both took a second set of cycling clothes, so that we thought, you know, after 2 or 3 days, we'll have fresh clothes to put on. Who cares? You know, 2 hours into the ride every morning, you're just gross and sweaty anyway, so why haul that? And my sister still, like I take cycling clothes that I have on me, and then I take shorts, t-shirt, shoes, and for evening, one set. That's what I wear each night after shower. And that's it. And then toothbrush and razor. And that's really it. Because you also have to haul some basic equipment. Like, you know, you got to haul inner tubes.
Right.
And you got to haul
tools,
you know, basic tools to fix. Yeah, because, I mean, we're on our own. That's the fun of it, is that what you have on your bike is what you have. And yeah, we're not too far from civilization at any given time, but still, you know, you want to be self-sufficient. And that's so the first time we hauled more than we needed. And so the second time, and now this time, I got it down to really, I was actually able to go. I have two bags, one fairly large and one a little bit smaller, and I was actually able, with some careful packing, to get everything in the smaller bag. So I was dancing in the streets. And my sister, she said she was having trouble getting her packing down. Well, she hauls this trifold makeup and toiletry bag, and I've told her, I said, hey, who cares? You know, just who cares? Leave all that stuff at home. Well, she can't do it. She can't bring herself to do that. And then we had 3 nights that we were in hotels. Well, she had a different outfit each of those nights. Granted, right. it was you know, like a straight dress, or you know, shorts or whatever. I mean, it wasn't a lot of weight, but still, it was 3 outfits. And I said, Nancy, you know, one of those, nobody, we're in 3 different towns, and I don't care, so nobody's going to notice. But she is, and I, you know, basically, if you're going to haul that weight, that's, you know, it's on you. That's your legs, not mine. But she gets along fine with it. But I just learned get it down to the bare minimum, and because I follow 2 or 3 people who do off-road single track bike packing, where you're just out in the wilderness and you're sleeping in a sleeping bag. You don't even take a tent. And
right.
And I started following those people. All right, what are these people who are gone 2 and 3 weeks in the wilderness? What are they taking? And you start to look at how they have, and you know, they have to be able to prepare some food or haul food with them. And they have, you know, half dozen water bottles hung off their bikes and the whole thing. And you know, so they're carrying a lot of weight to begin with. So they're experts at getting it down. And that's where I started looking at, I really don't need, you know, the same clothes every night is just fine. And you start to learn those things. So yeah, stitching, though I thought about it, stitching does not fit in. And quite frankly, most nights, we get showered and have dinner, laying there on the bed is just fine. I'm good. So Yeah, but it's fun. We really I really enjoy it doing these trips, and I don't know, we'll do something next year again too, but it's just fun. It's the challenge. Every day there's something that comes up, a road under construction, and we have to figure out how to get around it and those kinds of things. And one thing we've discovered that has worked, I would say 90% of the time, extremely well, is Google Maps on the bike setting.
Yeah.
And just one, I don't, when I ride, I don't wear headphones or earbuds. I don't listen to music. I don't think it's safe. But an earbud in my right ear, so my left ear, which is the traffic side, is open. And Google Maps, and then just tell it, I need to here by bike. And 90% of the time, they keep us on safe, low traffic roads and get us there. And we've enjoyed the trips each time. Every now and then it gets goofed up because the maps aren't quite matched up or something. But yeah, it's worked out really well. So that, when you have that kind of a tool, it really opens up. You can just say, well, all right, next year we'd like to go from here to here to here. And you know that you automatically have a tool that is going to map it out for you, so you don't spend hours prior to the trip figuring out where you're going to go. And
Right.
yeah, so that's worked out well. But yeah, it's a lot of fun to do. But yeah, no
Cool.
stitching, no stitching. Sorry. It's just one more thing, just can't do it. Yep. Minimal. You take, because these days you got a phone, and I've got a bike computer and a tail light. And so you got to have cords for all those, because that's got to get charged every night. There's all this stuff that goes with it. And yeah, you just got to get it to the minimum. So yeah. So we had fun doing that. But Kathy, hey, even though you're in the city, figure it out because it's fun. Yeah. Yep. I've been working. I sat down. Let's see, we're recording Tuesday. So yesterday, Labor Day, I finally, drag racing, the U.S. Nationals drag racing, 5 hours of drag racing, live drag racing. I finally got a chance to sit down and stitch for the first time in a week. Just,
Okay.
life has just been, yeah, that. So I'm still working my way around. Well, actually, I finished it now. The first row all the way around the outside of Sarah Brazier.
And
So got it. Nailed it.
nice.
But at coming down the sides at 300 stitches, because it's 482 down the side tall. I think it's 482. So down the side, I'm doing the half stitch, and then every 10 is an X. So I'm coming down both sides simultaneously, and I get to 300, and I think, I'm going to baste a thread across, because so far across you can't eyeball it. So I'm going to baste a thread across and see if I'm at 300 on both sides. I did. I was one stitch off.
Of course.
Yeah. So, but I was glad I did it and didn't get all the way to the bottom and discover that. So then I had to completely unroll the thing, well, I didn't have to clean off the dining room table. It's clean cleaned off all the time, but unroll the whole thing and then figure out. But if I had not done those in units of 10, that would have, counting all those stitches would have been multiple times to make sure I was accurate. But right away I found the problem, and it was in the first set of 10. I had done 11. On one side. So, but I was really glad I checked, because then it was, it was an easy thing to even out and then get down to the bottom and cut across and spot on. So I have that done. And I used, remember last week we talked about Angela Flannery Sawyer, if you have like a same color loading up a bunch of needles.
Yes.
Well, I did that. I took a strand of silk, or a silk thread, and separated it into strands and loaded up all the needles, one for each strand there, and put them in. I cut out a piece of felt and put them in there. And then as I was coming down the side, what I would do is set up a needle on each side. and then stitch down until that thread, one thread, say on the left side, was exhausted. And I wouldn't even finish it off on the back. I'd just go over to the other side and stitch that one down.
So you don't have to roll it.
Right. And that really, you know, I really was getting some momentum. And I'm doing half crosses, so I was finishing off the threads on the back side just because I don't have full crosses to make sure I have a hold. So I was finishing them off, and then I'll come back when I make the full X's, and that'll tie it down nice. But that really worked well. That little technique really worked well. And so then I would literally, when I'd end one, I'd just clip it off and put the needle on the needle minder and go get another one, line it up, and go. And, you know, I didn't have to separate another thread or cut anything, or, you know, just go. And it was, it didn't save me hours, but it certainly kept momentum going and made it move right along. And so that that's a real plus. And now that I have this done all the way around, then I'm going to go back to the top left, and then now I'm going to start working my way down, because I know that the outer frame is exact. So then I'm going to start stitching all the other things. So then I'll get out my my Paco holder and thread needles for the different colors, and then, you know, if I just use a little bit on one, I just put it back. But but for those other borders now that are the same color, yep, come do the same thing. And that really worked well. So I have that going, and then on top of it, I keep reminding myself that I'm going to start Xeroxing the port, like each little motif, like I talked about a long time ago, and cutting that out, and then pinning that or magneting it to the linen. So it's right there under my magnifier as I stitch each motif. So that's how I'm going to go about doing all those.
So I'll tell you a couple things that I've learned as I've been stitching this. So, and I'm going really slowly because I'm doing a lot of trial and error with color.
Right.
Because I'm not using, I'm using most of the same colors, but then I'm adding in blending filaments to bring some metallic to the colors. And then very occasionally I'll either make a color a little bit lighter or a little bit darker to just bring it a little bit away from the background fabric, because it's just too close in tone that it doesn't stand out enough. So, so I'll do that. But the gist of it is the same, right? So what I ended up doing to set this up, and this doesn't apply to samplers at all. This is universal, okay? What I did was I ended up photocopying the entire chart. And now that I've done other needlepoint charts, I would do the same thing, because I have a bunch of charts that I've completely marked up, and I don't think that's a problem. I know that would drive you crazy. I was just working on something yesterday that was Jessica, and you had to use it twice, use a particular instruction for Jessica twice. And it was a gigantic Jessica, probably, I want to say it was like 30 stitches or 30 threads across by 30 threads down. Like, that's how big it was.
Yeah.
So you had to mark, like, I really had to mark each one as I was doing it, because otherwise I was going to lose count.
Right.
So now that I know that this is actually a useful thing to do, what I did in this case was I photocopied in color the chart, and I did it in duplicate in this case because it is a motif-driven thing. If it was a needlepoint chart, I would just do a single one.
Yeah.
Put it in a little binder, just like a report cover binder, because a binder is just too unwieldy. And then I can just mark it up as I go, right? And especially for this, because I'm changing colors and doing all sorts of things, so I'm writing notes to myself, you know, as I go. I have a pencil and I have a pen, so things that I know I'm going to do, I'll write in pen, and things that I'm kind of iffy about, I'll write in pencil. So I don't feel bad about marking it up. And then the second page, in this case, that's the page that I'm tearing out as I go, so that I can magnet. And what I'm doing is just magneting the whole sheet, because with what I'm finding with this, I did the first one where I cut out the motifs, but what I'm finding is that when you do that, you lose the relationship between the things. So it's great that you have the motif, but then you end up referring back to the, well, where does this sit in relation to the other thing? So for me, I would even do, like, at the most or at the least, I would do half sheets.
Yeah.
Because then I have this motif and I'm like, yeah, but I don't know how far away it is from this other thing. So then I refer back to the chart anyway. So for me, that didn't work. But certainly having a sheet that I could tear out and fold up or do something, that worked out better. So there's that. But here's what I ended up doing. And it was kind of a tag along to something we talked about last week, where you're talking about the Paco sort of tool. In my little report cover, on the last sheet of this particular chart, the last sheet is the thread guide, essentially, where it lists out all the different threads. And in a different Debbie Raleigh design that I'm working on, the last sort of the back cover of the design lists out all the threads. And I think that's not uncommon that you would have a sheet that right. would be sort of your thread, you know, atlas, if you will.
Right, yeah.
Your legend. And if I didn't have that, I would write one out and use that as my last page. And I would probably photocopy that too, because it ends up getting messy. So what I did was I had that as my last page, and I took magnets. I did exactly what we talked about. And it wasn't written out in an easy way. So I just wrote them on the sort of the margin of the paper going down the page. And I wrote out the DMC number and then the symbol. And then I put a magnet on each one. So right down the margin of the page on the side, that's the edge. So the right side of the page,
mm-hmm.
as you flip it open, there's all these magnets. And next to each magnet is the symbol for that. And then the DMC thread name or number in case I need it. And each one has a magnet. So what I've been doing with that is if I go and thread up a whole bunch of needles, I can throw them there if I'm not using them. Or I tend to be kind of frugal with threads, because I don't, especially if I'm kind of doing things in a way that's not the way I'm supposed to, I don't know if I'm going to run out of things. So if I use half a thread, I don't want to throw it away.
Right.
So I'll park it right in the chart.
Mm-hmm.
So now I have all of my threads, sort of working threads, that are not threaded up in sort of on little bobbins on rings. And then whatever I have threaded up on a needle, what I was doing prior to our conversation was saying, oh, yeah, I'll know what that is. And then pretty much within fraction of a second forgetting what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So now I just take it and I park it right in the chart, right with a magnet.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, if I need a thread, I just look there first and say, oh, yeah, I have a little bit of thread left, or no, I don't have anything, and then I'll thread one up. So that has worked out really well. And I think I'll probably end up doing that with any charted design from now on, just because it's a really nice way to do it.
Yeah. Yep.
It's just an easy way to sort of keep threads, and it's a good reference, too, to what you have. And then you don't feel like – I don't feel like I'm – sort of wasting threads because I forget what I have.
Right, right.
It just seems to work out well. And it's these little magnets, as long as I have them, it's an easy thing to do, to just, you know, run, you know, 12 or however many magnets up and down the side of the chart, and then just draw the little symbol right next to them.
Yep.
And then it's right in there, and I don't need another piece of, you know, another tool to do it.
Right. Yeah, and magnets are cheap. And
they're really cheap.
And when you're done, they just become a stack. So it's not like there's a storage problem.
Yeah. And for this, so K&J, so this is the place that I've been getting them from. They always have these magnets that are the oops magnets, kind of, which are the ones that they've made by, you know, that they made for somebody for a custom design and then they didn't use them for anything.
Uh-huh.
So they're ridiculously inexpensive. So you can buy 50 of them for, you know, some ridiculous low sum of money. And they're just little flat discs. So
yeah.
They're perfect for the kind of thing that we're doing. And then you just reuse them over and over again. So yeah.
You lose them. Yeah. How do they ship magnets like that if you buy a bunch of them? They just put them in a bubble envelope?
In the mail.
But, I mean, what are they used for packing your material? They put them in a box or?
No. Just in a Ziploc bag and in a bubble envelope.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Just curious. Yeah. Always wonder
They're
what.
They're easy.
Always wonder what a bunch of magnets going through electronic devices do, but.
Nothing. I mean, you can get fancy with them. They have rubber coated ones. They have, you know, discs ones. They have ones that are, they, you know, have like are donut shaped. I mean, they have all kinds of different applications for them, and they come in all different widths. So you can have their squares and circles. There's different thicknesses of them. There's different widths of them. So you can get large circles and small circles. They come, you know, a millimeter wide up to an inch wide, depending on your application. Because, you know, you can use them for earrings or all kinds of things. So, you know, you get the size that, that works for you. But they also come in strengths. So it pretty much any of them are going to work for us. So I just get, you know, at least an eighth of an inch thick and at least a quarter of an inch wide, just because that way they're easily manageable.
Yeah, yeah, at some point, yeah, too small, and it's just,
yeah,
like, yeah.
They're just, yeah, then they're just a pain to use. Right. But, you know, it, if you get much bigger than that, then they start getting a little bit more expensive. So, you know, I usually check their sort of their odds and ends section first to see if there's anything useful. If there is, then I pick those up. But I you know, I find this is like the Velcro. So my son always makes fun of me because I will find any and all reasons to use industrial Velcro for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a longstanding joke in my family since he was little, because I would hang like brooms and mops with industrial Velcro in the insides of closets. Like, I would find every reason. Like, if I could, I would run Velcro around our entire garage and our basement to hang things. Like, I'll find the craziest ways to use it. But now magnets are the thing, so I don't know.
Well, and you have gluing expertise, so yeah, you can
do
amazing things.
Now I know how to alternate the glue, and but the crazy glue works really well on them. They, once you crazy glue them and don't glue them to each other, they really work well. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, you know, that's crazy glue. Now, we know this from our aquarium days, but a lot of people, I don't think, realize that there's crazy glue, which is that really runny stuff, but there's also a crazy glue that is a more gel, like toothpaste consistency, a whole lot easier to deal with, and just as effective, but much easier to deal with, because a lot of times that the crazy glue in the tube with the little narrow spout, it runs all over, or the spout gets plugged up, and then you got to fight your way through it. But, yeah, you can buy tubes of crazy glue in a gel format. Toothpaste, and really a whole lot.
Loctite.
Yeah, a lot easier to, A lot easier to deal with. Much easier to control, the whole bit,
Right, and that said, so if you're going to be gluing them down, so if your surface is horizontal, what they sell, because crazy glue has now gotten smart to this, they sell crazy glue. You can buy packs of six, and there's only about 2 milliliters in each one. So, you know, you're not going to waste it, because if it hardens up in the tube, you've lost almost nothing. So you just buy a pack of them instead of buying a tube, because you waste the tube because the whole thing hardens up.
Yeah.
You just buy that, and then you throw away the tube, and you're done.
Yeah.
So there's not too much waste. But, yeah, the gel stuff works really well.
Yeah. For me, yeah, just a whole lot easier to control all the way around. So, yeah. Yep. Okay, I got in the car today, and the car automatically hooks up to the phone. And up pops the last Gayan Rogers show that we did, and I had a good half hour drive, so I knew I could hear the whole show round trip. And I think the third or fourth time I've listened to it, that show, I'll tell anybody who's not listened to that show, every time I hear it, I learn something else, you know, something else sticks in my head. And that Gayan just was spot on with that. She was just right on it that night in terms of information and tips and ideas. But the one thing that kept hitting me is the saying that she was using, and I looked it up, attributed to Voltaire, that better is the enemy of good. And we had a bit of a discussion with her about that and what that means. And it really got me thinking about that whole concept because you had mentioned in the discussion about how you're looking for that next level with your stitching. And but I think that the thing that stuck with me in this go around was you do it well, but you didn't do it, you don't do it as well as it could be. But it isn't that you go back necessarily, that you go back and redo this time, but you save that for the next time, and you realize the next time I do a project, this is the next level, and I've learned that lesson from the previous one. And you really got me, that got me thinking, because I'm the one who would think about and then tear it all out and do it over anyway. But it really got me thinking about better is the enemy of good. And what, how we approach stitching all the way around, and if you apply that and think of that in a positive term, that you can really advance your stitching with each project
Yes.
by learning. Yeah.
Right, you
Yeah.
split the difference, right? So you can have a good piece and you can have your next piece better.
Yes. Right. If and that's yeah, it can, but the key is that you have to have that intent in mind. In that, okay, I finished this piece. All right, I'm going to mentally review what I did. This part could be a level better if I did this, and then make the mental note or actually write it down. And so the next time I encounter this kind of a stitch or this kind of a situation or design, this is how I'm going to approach it, because now I know from this from my previous experience that I can be a level better with it. And if you're conscious of that, then I think you really can make progress with the quality of your stitching. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, that was it was just good, and it was just again to hear that exchange with her, and the discussion about making the piece your own, where she said, I'll never know if you stitched it the way I designed it, and why would you? It's your piece. And I love the description. I put up the studs. What she said, I put up the studs, and then you fill it in with what you want, the interior design that you want on those studs. She just gives you the studs. And I thought that really captured it just perfectly. And if you think about it that way, and then coupled with that, where she said, never stitch a color you don't like.
Yes, I like that too. There's no
Yeah.
time for stitching things you don't like.
Right.
Unless you're stitching it for someone else and
Yep.
you love them.
That. Yeah, well, there would be that. Yeah. But that was, and I when I heard that, I had read the other day somebody had written that they had were stitching on something, and now they were to the colors that they were looking forward to stitching. And that stuck in my mind as an interesting thing, meaning struggle through this because I want to get to these colors. And then to hear Gayanne say, never stitch a color that you don't like. And so then I take it back to that person's statement and say, all right, all of that struggle where you're basically holding the carrot of these colors I want to stitch in front of you, why are you doing that to yourself?
Ah, see, but there, I think there's a difference because I think that you can't love, well, you're not always going to love every color in
Yes.
every piece that you do because sometimes there are going to be colors that serve as support structures for the colors that you love, right? That, if you love this particular teal, aqua green, that, you may need some sort of, in order to make that color stand out, you might need some sort of, like a pale, I don't know, even almost like a sort of a dull
Yeah.
peachy color underneath it, like somewhere else in the piece. That is not color you would ever in a million years choose, but that's the color that is going to next to that teal green color make that color stand out because they're opposites, right?
Right.
So sometimes you do need to choose a color that you don't like by itself, but you have to take it in the context of what job it's doing for you.
Yes, exactly that. Yeah. Yeah. I don't care for this color, but when I put this color next to that teal green, look what happens. And so then you get that little adrenaline rush and, oh man, I got to put more of this in because look what it's doing over here. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to consider what job that's doing for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, that podcast, with Gay Ann Rogers, that was August 12th.
Mm-hmm.
I just really encourage every, well, both, we did two of them within a month, but that particular one on August 12th, you know, I really encourage people to listen to that. And it doesn't matter what you stitch. It doesn't matter if it's cross stitch, samplers, needlepoint. It just doesn't matter. What she talks about in there and the things that she says about how she puts together designs and studies and understands threads and colors applies everywhere. And to me, of all the people and all the things we've had, that one is standing out for me time and again as just one of those shows that you can listen to and keep learning from. Yeah, she's amazing. And today I got email from Gay Ann Rogers. Okay, what can we do for Gay Ann today? Mm-hmm. And, well, I had bought that the Tudor Rose design.
Yeah.
When she had a sale, mm-hmm. I'd put down it was $50, I think. And that was a couple months ago, and I'm thinking, well, you know, it'll come up in the fall. So I just mentally put that just. Erase that from my current number of things to think about. You know, that's in the fall. And then I got it today, and it was, all right, it's time to pay the rest so you can get your kit. And I stopped to think, well, but that's in the fall.
Yeah.
Guess where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I'll be buying that. But it was just one of those moments like, wait a minute, that's coming up in the fall. And then, yeah, well, that time passed. Yep.
Yep.
So, yeah, but then it was like, oh, that's right, that thing. Ooh, send it quickly. Because I got nothing else to stitch, so, you know, fire it off.
Oh, no, nothing.
No, completely bored out of my mind. Yep. Yep. So, go listen to that Gay Ann, August 12th, Gay Ann Rogers show. That's when we use the Queen Victoria design that she just released and then sold out of within 2 days. You'll want to have, we made the pictures available either on the FlossTube or on the website, but helpful if you can have that picture in front of you as we discuss a lot of it, because it will help you understand, or not in front of you, but certainly look at it as before you listen, because it will help you understand what we're talking about. But just a tremendous design, but within that is... just an awful lot of design insight and talent. And I was having an exchange with Jane Wood about that, about her designs. And Gay Ann Rogers said the same thing, that and Jane said that the stitching on that isn't difficult on any of her designs. It's never difficult. But what makes them shine is the execution. It's the tension and all the little things that bring out the maximum in the threads. But none of these stitches are difficult at all. And she even talked about that in the podcast, about, you know, really the most difficult was a French knot. And, you know, how difficult is that? So,
right.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, just I really encourage people to listen to that. It's just really good. Okay, we got to wrap up. So... Sunday, we have Susan Boggan, and we haven't recorded yet, so I have not heard her name come from her voice, but it's Boggon, from Australia. Pintangle is her website, and boy, what a talented lady on several fronts. So we have Susan from Pintangle in Australia coming Sunday, and that's embroidery, and I cannot wait to talk to her. Crazy quilts. Because I do not get crazy quilts, but
oh, they're so much fun.
I am so fascinated by them. Yeah, yeah. So, because every time I see one, I think, wow, look what that is. So, yeah. So that's Sunday. And then I have to be gone all of next week. So next Wednesday, our show will be a sampler tour that several samplers that I did with Nicola Parkman when we were at Sassy Jack's. So we'll have a video next Wednesday. And then the following Sunday, we will have Kimberly Ann Carter. And Kimberly from Indiana, she is another one of those young painted canvas designers. We've had several, Shana last week, and Kimberly in 2 weeks, painted canvas designers who are these young people who are getting into this hobby and doing design work and cranking out some fascinating painted canvases, and in the process bringing young people into the hobby. And so much fun to talk to her, and fun to talk to all of those young designers, because they're the future. And what they're doing and how they're going about it, and you know, operating out of their homes and painting on the dining room table and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so that's the following Sunday. So that's our lineup for the next 3 days while I'm off in Germany.
Yay. Very nice.
Yeah, Germany. I do not like going to Europe. The time changes and the flights, just no. They don't get along with me.
All right, then.
Way it is. Yep. Okay, that's it. We're done.
Sounds good. Take care.